and welcome back to the Enduro World Series podcast. Firstly, and I know that we said this last time, but honestly, a genuine thank you to everyone who's listened so far. It seems that you like it, and by the laws that govern modern media, if you like it, we'll keep making it. We are now available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. And hopefully we've got another couple of platforms in the offing too. My name is Rick McLaughlin, and joining me as ever is the mountain biking equivalent of poacher turned gamekeeper, racer extraordinaire, and the Enduro World Series sports coordinator, Rory Cunningham. Rory, how are you?
I'm very well, Rick. How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah, I'm not too bad. Towards the end of another busy week on Planet Enduro World Series, so let's get cracking. We need to pick up this week where we left off last time. If you've not listened to episode 2 yet, we chatted about the silly season, as it's commonly known, the sort of transfer window of riders moving different teams, moving around the place a wee bit. And as we pointed out then, there was probably going to be a few more announcements before we next aired. And there has been a big one, and that is the announcement that Da Vinci are putting all their eggs in the Enduro basket going forwards. Their team stays the same largely this season with Greg Callahan, Keegan Wright, but they've also added Georgia Astle to the programme as well, so that's it's a good wee squad, Roy.
It is, and it's cool to see Da Vinci exclusively focus on Enduro. I'd heard through the grapevine that Junior and Da Vinci, which was the factory team for the last couple of years, were parting ways. I didn't know where that left the Enduro team and Da Vinci, but they've committed to Da Vinci factory racing and maintained the same squad, and it's a strong one.
Da Vinci, one of those brands that, like, I'm obviously an avid race fan, and they are just one of those racing brands, aren't they? I was lucky enough to be there in 2013 in Leagang when Stevie Smith won the World Cup overall with them, the late great Stevie Smith, and
best finish line dismount of all time, I think.
I still don't know how he did that.
Incredible.
If you haven't seen what we're talking about, it YouTube, Stevie Smith Leagang 2013, he sort of
pirouetted the bike one-handed and then dropped it as he was putting his hands in the air to celebrate. Incredible.
I think it nearly took Gabe Fox out, didn't it? I think he was on his way over to celebrate with Stevie, and next thing there was a Da Vinci Wilson heading towards his head. But
his head, to be honest.
That was an absolutely superb finish. And I don't know, they're just Da Vinci, I think that win, that's always sort of stuck in my head. Damien Auton, multiple EWS podiums, he's always done really well as well, and I think it's just it's a really good affirmation that the sport's heading in the right area, I think the right direction, that a brand like Da Vinci is putting all their efforts into it. Greg Callahan as well, I think his first year in Da Vinci last season, and I think that I think a bit of a sighter for Greg, you know, not a full, he's a championship rider, isn't he? I think the free races we had last year maybe couldn't just get into the sort of stride that he would have wanted to, but definite signs of some speed there.
Yeah, he was a little bit hot and cold at the three races we had last year, but like you say, he's in it for the season, you know. Greg's there or thereabouts every weekend. It'll be, you know, another kind of off-season, getting the bike as he wants it, developing that. So I'd expect to see him strong this year, and, a very strong rider, very physical. I think he's he definitely doesn't shy away from a bit of pedaling and the stuff that hurts. So, you know, with the season coming up and a lot of blocks of racing and some back-to-back racing, double events, you know, I'd expect to see him right up there at the pointy end.
Listen,
things get physical and hard.
Listen, we know Greg is going to be right in amongst it this year, purely on the telltale sign that he has grown a big old Irish beard, which everyone knows is the secret to going fast in this game.
I don't have a leg to stand on when it comes to commenting on hair, on facial hair or head hair. So, he means business clearly, and yeah, look forward to seeing him at the pointy end this year.
It's a good beard. I'm all for it, Greg. If you're listening, let's get you on and we can talk about beard care together. Next up on my news sheet here is the announcement of Specialized EWS and EWSE Crans Montana in Switzerland for 2021. Now, the eagle-eyed amongst you will have spotted on the calendar that we released earlier in the year, we simply had Swiss Alps marked down. We can confirm that that race will take place in Crans Montana. We haven't raced at that venue before, but it is a part of the world that we know really well, the Valais region. I mean, saying that it's a beautiful part of Switzerland, all of Switzerland's beautiful, do you know what I mean? But it is an absolutely stunning, stunning part of the world. Rory, from a course designer's point of view, 2,300 vertical metres to play with there. And from what Nick has told us, Nick's one of the guys on the ground down there, Astronaut Wolf, one of the best Instagram handles I think I've ever come across. He's telling us that it's got all the scope to be an absolute classic. I think there's some sort of more modern bike part. There's old, beaten up, like, Alpine bike part. There's hand-cut stuff, loam. Like, it just sounds like an absolute paradise.
Yeah, I'm sure the course is going to be great, but have you seen the golf course?
Is there a golf course?
Oh, there's like a...
Oh, the Masters goes there, doesn't it? The Omega Masters goes there.
It looks the Omega Masters. It looks incredible. I mean, yeah, I'm sure the race will be great, but, man, the golf course looks good. So, I'll be looking forward to taking some divots out of that if I can afford the green fees.
I'll dig my way around there with you. Yeah, I mean, what's interesting, I think, there as well is that it's a new venue right towards the tail end of the calendar as well, whenever the points battle is going to come into play. And you only have to look back two seasons ago. We had, you know, we went into Zermatt with Florian Nicolai narrowly ahead of Sam Hill before Sam clinched that title. Switzerland's got a habit of deciding things.
Yeah, I think the terrain there, like you say, is beautiful, but it's pretty exposed and can be pretty rugged. We'll see. I mean, I always like a new venue. I feel it's like a bit of a level playing field for everybody. Ludenville the week before, everybody were coming up to that race a bit kind of fresh faced, and yeah, I think it'll be really good. You've got obviously the e-bike race there as well, so a big week in store. But yeah, that'll be kind of right in the middle of the second block of racing, and by that point, I'm sure the title favourites will have worked their way to the front of the championship, and we'll have, you know, 2-3 contenders really going for it, and a new venue. It's a nice curveball in the mix.
Yeah, I mean, we need to talk about that as well, don't we? The fact that there's going to be an EWSE there. What's, I think, really exciting from anyone listening to this at home who fancies coming to an EWS or an EWSE event this year and having a crack themselves, there are lots and lots of ways to get involved. That's going to be a double round. So if you're an amateur and you want to come and have a go, ride the same stages as your heroes, there'll be an EWS 50, an EWS E 100, an EWS 80, and an EWS 100. All of those events, you can just come have a go at. It kind of feels very... We've all been stuck in the same lockdown boat, haven't we, for a while now? And it kind of feels that once outdoor events sort of open up later in the year, the atmosphere at these races is going to be fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I think the lockdowns we've had certainly in the UK, it's incredible to see how many people have got outdoors and got on bikes, and I think outdoor sports in general have taken a massive leap forward with the number of people taking part. And I think when competitions open, like you say, the demand will be there. And you know, we've always had quite a big amateur field for the EWS, and you know, this year we're looking to increase that, and yeah, I think the demand's going to be pretty high. But it's healthy for the sport, and it's amazing that there's that demand for gravity racing. If you want to be a part of it, get your name down, and we'll see you there.
Be ready as well, because I think the two of us had just actually started our full-time EWS careers just before entries went live for last year's season. And I mean, there's 7,000 spots available this year, more than we've ever had. There's more rounds than we've ever had before, more teams than there's ever been before. But the competition to actually get one of those starting spots is intense. I would definitely, I'd recommend, if you get 5 minutes, go and check out EnduroWorldSeries.com, have a look on our socials, and just get yourself familiar with the actual entry process, how we're going to do things, and check out the rounds. Maybe have like a couple that you definitely want to be in the running for, then have some backup ones as well. Just a bit of an explainer, EWS E50 and EWS E100, they are, well, tell you what I'm doing your job for me, explain to me what EWS E50 and EWS E100 are.
So the EWS E50 is 50% of the EWS E course. So obviously the pros, and they do three loops with a number of stages per loop, and the loops are designed around battery changes to keep them fast and in turbo mode for most of the day, which is cool. EWS E50 is 50% of the course, and it's designed to be done on one battery rather than multiple batteries. So for amateurs that have got their e-bike and just one battery, it's perfect for them. They'll ride the majority of the stages, and there's no set start and finish times for the stages. They've got a set time to complete the course. They can go around at their own pace. They can go around with mates. Nice, relaxed day. You can ride the same trails as the pros. And yeah, I mean, the perfect start to get into it.
I'd love to do one of these. And I guess the kind of point is you can do one and then finish with time to go and spectate and see, you know, see how close you actually were to the pros in terms of speed, which in my case wouldn't be that close. But yeah, I mean, the competition is going to be fierce to get hold of those spots, but they're going to be worth their weight in gold. I think it's going to be an absolutely incredible season to come and have a go at that. So as I say, do check out EnduroWorldSeries.com ahead of entries going live. Now, in terms of tech stuff, this week we've had the launch of another rather nice looking bike, the Forbidden Dreadnought. You had a chance to have a look at this? It's broken cover?
I believe I did, yes. Yeah, I mean, the Forbidden's a pretty cool company, to be honest. It's quite a relatively new company, and they're not copying any specific design there. They're certainly paving their own way, and you know, a very good looking high pivot trail bike with an idler pulley. So yeah, I mean, last time we spoke about, you know, trail bikes and enduro bikes gearing up specifically to be ridden on the downhills, and I think if you know we're seeing a bike that's 150 mil of travel with a high pivot and idler pulley, it kind of shows what riders are prioritizing when it comes to performance, and it certainly isn't climbing efficiency.
Well, this is it. On paper, the geometry very, very close to the Nukeproof Giga, which we talked about on the first episode of this. You ever ridden a bike with an idler pulley? What does that feel like?
I've ridden a Common Saddle briefly, but not with any sort of anger. It's something. I mean, you can definitely see why it's an advantage and the performance advantages of it. You know, the high pivot. And I literally give it a rearward axle path, which means that for anybody, a rearward axle path means that the rear center, so from the bottom bracket to the axle, instead of getting shorter under compression or under suspension load, it gets longer. And the rearward axle path kind of helps with square edge hits and kind of moves the back end back and out of the way. Conversely, though, like, this is something, I mean, you heard it here first, folks, but it does mean that under deep in the travel or under a lot of load, that the bike actually becomes quite long, or the rear centre becomes quite long. Now, there's quite a few cases of riders on, specifically on downhill bikes with high pivots, going over the handlebars on jumps, specifically kicky jumps. So if you think that your bike gets, most bikes get shorter on the takeoff, so they're easier to control because the wheelbase is shorter. And if a bike gets longer, especially towards the rear, it's more weight behind the rider's hips. Think Omri Pirin at the bottom of Fort William.
This is turning into some kind of like conspiracy theory podcast
Ben
now.
On at Leo Gang. And then I think we saw two riders this year in Maribor both go over the handlebars on that step down.
And is that, wow.
On the same team. There is something to it. I'm not saying that it can be worked around, but yeah, it's certainly something that I've noticed, and I don't think it's coincidence. Maybe I'm being a conspiracy theorist or just a nibbler, but there's something to it.
We should point out at this stage, you do love a theory. I was actually, I was at the bottom of that Fort William run interviewing Pierron after that. For all the world, it looked like he was about to detonate himself into that finish area, but somehow he didn't. I think that Forbidden's a great looking bike. I like the Druid before it. This one's called the Dreadnought, which, let's face it, like, that's a great name, isn't it? To casually throw around the kitchen, I'm just gonna nip out in the Dreadnought. You're not riding a Dreadnought to hang around, are you, to make up the numbers? 29-inch wheels, 170mm travel fork, as you say, 150mm back end. What I like about this is that it's visually sort of confusing because, on one hand, it's a really complex, multifaceted design, yet they've managed to package it to still somehow look really good. Do you know what I mean? It's still like a really sort of aesthetically pleasing bike, despite the fact there's lots going on. I love to try one. I'm a bit fascinated by these because this is a bit like the way turbo technologies come back to small cars, in that this was quite an old thing originally, the idler pulley and the sort of high single pivot, and then everyone, the whole industry, just sort of moved away from it, and now one by one these brands are starting to bring it back. And the Cominsale downhill bike, that really is kind of it's the privateer go-to now, isn't it? It's after Pierron's exploits on it.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt in that the system works. Was it I'm trying to think, was it Sun or was it V Process or was it that team that used to have the
Sun had well? One, yeah. The Sun had one. Cannondale had that one with chains all over the place on it, and it was.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing like you say, we've seen the success of the Cominsale. I know there's a big American brand. I may or may not have ridden for them in the past. They've got one coming out, so I'll leave that to the people to work out who that might be. And yeah, I mean, it certainly seems that, you know, technology sometimes does the full circle, and we're seeing the success of it in Cominsale, and yeah, it seems right that other brands would look at that and go, well, you know, if it's working for them, then we should give it a shot. And you know, it's cool to see it roll over into enduro bikes, and you know, I'm sure the Forbidden Dreadnought's going to be quite the bike.
I think no matter what happens this year, they could well have won Bike Name of the Year 2021 already. I think it's more proof, isn't it? We've talked about this before, but it's more proof that the bike industry probably correctly seems to think that bigger's better when it comes to travel on these bikes, because you look at that thing and it's seriously well sprung.
Yeah, like we spoke about, Rick, I think the sport's evolving, and riders are demanding more out of their equipment, and I think we'll begin to see more brands follow suite, and you know, we'll see more long travel enduro bikes gracing the stages this year.
One of the things I'd like to talk about today as well, we hang out, of course, in the same Google Drive system. And I'm starting to see some of the numbers of particularly EWSE courses begin to surface. And we don't want to give too much away. As I say, entries are going live on the 15th. But we're talking, you know, some of the vertical meters of descent we're seeing in some of the e-bike courses are absolutely mind-blowing, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, it'd be really easy for us to just adopt the same kind of pattern as EWS courses, but you know, with three loops and where these bikes can go and the terrain they can climb and how quickly they can access the higher mountains, you know, we're really working with organisers. And you know, the first EWSE course in Valberg, I believe the kind of figures of the descending figures or the descending meters proposed for the race is 4,500.
That's incredible, isn't it? That is, just take a second to think about that. 4.5 kilometres up in the air. It's mental.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think my hands and arms would would hold on for that long, yeah, to be honest.
There's not enough cartilage left in my body to do the course preview for that. And then I think later on in the year, there's talk of like finale being in around 6,000, isn't there, vertical meters?
Yeah, it's a work in progress, but yeah, we might see something pretty special EWSE-wise towards the end of the year. So
I think that's just, I mean, it's proof, isn't it, that any amateur out there listening to this who wants to have one of the biggest adventures you'll have on your e-bike in 2021, get onto that start line, because those courses just sound absolutely amazing. And I think it's what we're beginning to see is mountain bike resorts and, you know, locations famed for their trails going, okay, we see e-bikes, we hear e-bikes, let's really start to test them, and let's really up the limits.
Yeah, I think Pietra last year was, I think, some of the terrain they were choosing as liaisons, and how technical some of the sections in the power stages were, it was pretty eye-opening, even for me, as to what these bikes are capable of. And I think we're only going to see that develop more and more, the, you know, as technology improves and as riders improve and adapt with it, I think we'll see some pretty incredible and pretty incredible riding and some pretty incredible terrain.
Do you think if you take sort of power units and drive units out of the conversation, do you think there's much tech stuff we're going to see coming into play this season in EWSE? Are we going to see, I mean, we've joked about it before, the return of the travel to Just Fork, so you can slam your front end for the power stage. But I mean, joking aside, people were ratchet strapping their forks down last season. Do you think we're going to see stuff like that up here?
Oh, it's difficult to say, isn't it? I think as we're seeing with the EWS, I think we'll begin to see more long travel e-bikes. Certainly, if we look at what we were riding in 2020 and what we're going to be riding in 2021 with Santa Cruz, with going from the Heckler, which I think was 140 mil of travel, to the Bullet, which is it 170 or 180 mil of travel,
yeah.
And Mullet. It seems to be all going in the same direction. So you know, battery and motor aside, I'd imagine the technology will follow relatively close to the EWS bikes, but it is intriguing. You definitely feel like there's some scope there. I'm as a motocross fan, you see they have what they call hole shot devices, where they have like a kind of button on their fork guard, and as the fork compresses, it locks in. And you're seeing, I don't know if anybody follows it, but you're seeing riders going all around the first corner. It's not until they hurt the first jump that it breaks free and goes back to full travel. But obviously with upside down or inverted forks, it's much easier. But, you know, is there a way of having something attached to the stanchion that goes down and locks in? I don't know. I mean,
the way I look at it is Tracy Mosley in Zermatt was ratchet strapping her fork down, and Tracy Mosley doesn't do anything unless it's faster. So that tells me that it mightn't be a return to the U-turn travel adjust, but I think we're gonna have to see some way of keeping these front ends down. Now, let's move on to, finally, I'm excited about this because this is something you've organised. Rory has bravely stuck his head above the parapet and put out an Ask Us Anything on his Instagram story, and I believe you've collated some questions for us to have a chat about from the listeners.
Yeah, I put it out to the millions of listeners that what did they want us to discuss on the podcast, and we got a good amount of things. Worryingly, the first question was from you asking if we'd written a script for tomorrow. At 9 o'clock last night wasn't the most reassuring thing, but
we got there. The script got written. That's fine. Right, give us another one.
Yeah, you turned that round.
Yeah.
A lot of people asking how the Schlid's doing.
We should just sort of fill this in for people. The Schlid is the nickname given to Rory's absolutely magnificent lockdown haircut. I think that was a Pietra nickname, wasn't it? It just came out one day. Look at the Schlid, and it's kind of stuck around, hasn't it? Literally, like the haircut itself, only getting bigger and more popular.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, with barbers being closed, I've not had the chance yet to get it cut. But it's at its day, I think. Final straw was a couple of mornings ago when my fringe flopped into my coffee, and I couldn't decide what was worse, the fact that I'd got hair in my coffee or the fact that I'd got coffee on my fringe. So
we need to, I think if that haircut hangs around any longer, we need to get on to Santa Cruz and try and get hold of some branded like Rasta hats to enclose it, because you've just blown the top out of your current Santa Cruz beanie, haven't you? So we need to crack on with that.
Indeed. What other questions do we get? I quite like this one. Who would do better in a fight against the grizzly bear, Mark Scott or Eddie Masters?
Well, in a fight against a grizzly bear, I'm going to go for Mark Scott.
Really?
Yeah, well, the only thing counting against him winning it for me is that he's vegan. But I kind of think that if it came to taking on a bear hand to hand, that would go out the window and Mark would just get it done. Eddie, for me, too nice a guy to go hand to hand with a bear. What do you think?
It's a tough one. I don't think Mark would fight it, but I think he could maybe outrun it. If you put Mark on a bike and the bear chased him, I think the bear would probably tire before Mark would.
They can do 40 mile an hour. Is that bears that can do 40 mile an hour?
Something hideous like that. Eddie's pretty scrappy, I think. You never know. I mean, if maybe the sun might shine off his toe ball head and blind the bear, and he'd maybe have a chance. Maybe he could give it the left right good night, and it'd be Eddie 1, bear 0.
It'd be all over before dinner. Right, give us another one.
What else do we have? This is a good one. Which country do you want to have an EWS in that hasn't yet hosted one?
Ooh.
Because I've had the questions in front of me all day, I've thought about this already. I would love to go to Japan.
Japan? Now, that's a great answer, because there's been a downhill there, hasn't there? Arai Mountain.
Yeah, in
2001? 2001, was it? Or 2005?
I think it sprung, so it's a long time ago.
Yeah, that was always one of those, like, whenever I was getting into downhill as a kid, watching it, getting into mountain bike racing, you know, places like Arai Mountain and like Vigo, and like, I had no idea where they were. Like, they could have been like a racetrack on a computer game for all I knew. But yeah, something about that stuck around. We spoke about Stevie Smith earlier in the podcast. He had a video part, didn't he, for Red Bull in Japan somewhere. Mark Scott, the bear fighter off the borders, he's been out there, hasn't he, with the 50-1 boys doing stuff, and
he loved it, said it was great. So
right, so you're saying Japan. I'm gonna say I'd quite like to go to Scandinavia. I've always fancied a sort of a wander around up there, and from the look of all the riding and the fast riders that tend to come from that part of the world, Robin Wallner, Zach Johansson, Braga, Vestavik. I fancy a bit of that, and it's also going to be cold, which I really like. So yeah, I'm going
to do with all the rallying there, though.
Nothing to do with the rallying. Yeah, Finland, Onapoya for the rally. Go on.
I think Finland's a bit flat, but didn't hold back Matti Laikkanen.
No, true. Another good Scandinavian bike rider.
Yeah, arguably one of the best, and I think another Finnish rider from, is it Katja Riipo?
Yeah, Katja Riipo.
I'm pretty sure she won a World Cup a long time ago. Moving on. Thoughts on teams showing up early to pre-ride?
Right.
Because when I raced downhill, this was something that got discussed a lot about, people are showing up early to pre-ride enduro courses, and when I actually raced enduro, didn't seem to happen.
I think this is one of those problems that the internet thinks is a problem that isn't a problem.
Yeah, it kind of is. I think we obviously close the courses usually 7 days in advance of the race, sometimes 10. With the way the season's shaping up this year, there's a lot of back-to-back racing. So unless people are travelling back in time between races, they're not going to be able to pre-ride the course because everything will be closed when they get there. But yeah, I kind of agree with you. I think it's something that gets discussed a lot and maybe blown up, and it seems to be more advantageous than it actually is. Every venue's got its local riders and people who know the terrain well and go well, but at the end of the day, you know, Sam Hill's been the series champion for the last 3 years, and there's only been one race in Australia and he didn't win.
What? Hold on. Somebody's done a bit of research here. I've got kind of two takes on this. The first is that I don't buy it because I kind of think that every race course, regardless of what the sport is, every racetrack on the earth is someone's local track.
Mm-hmm.
You'll never get away from that. And secondly, if that is obviously true, but if you look at the results, as you say, it doesn't stack up. Do you know what I mean? Like, you've got different rounds that we go to that different pros, they're from that part of the world. It doesn't mean they're a nailed on win. Do you know what I mean? Like, Teo Galli and Olarg or Adrian Day and Finale, you know, they're from that part of the world roughly. But it doesn't mean that. I mean, if we go riding in Dunkeld, I'm not going to drop in front of you and think I'm going to keep you behind me for the whole way, am I? Like, I think these guys are operating at such a high level that racing's racing, and I don't think having perhaps a more ingrained idea of where you're going is particularly going to make the difference.
No, I think it's more down to how people ride than how well they know it. And I guess it's something from our side as well. Like, if we set a rule, we've got to be able to enforce it. And if we're enforcing that riders aren't allowed to ride the course 10 days ahead of the race, anything beyond that is really difficult. Obviously, we don't mark any of the course until the course is announced. And once the course is announced, people aren't allowed to ride it. But at the same time, you know, we go to places like Whistler and Finale, and, you know, these are huge resorts with literally dozens of tracks. We can't close all these stages 2 weeks in advance because we want to post a race there. There's thousands of public that need access to them as well. So it's always a balance. But like you say, I think the cream always rises to the top. Every track's got its local. And ultimately, the series champion isn't the person or isn't the rider that's going to be showing up to each venue 2 weeks in advance and having an advantage. It's going to be the person that performs the best week on week. And, you know, we've never had a season decided by a local advantage. It's always been by the best rider, ultimately, at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I think also maybe it's something that people look at the prism, maybe they look at it through the prism of Strava and, like, online times that they're doing, you know, like, where an actual local knowledge will make the difference. But I think at an international level of sport, I think that the pressure's on, as you, I mean, we've talked a bit about downhill in this podcast. If you look at riders like Troy Brosnan, you know, unbelievably consistent and doesn't have a home round on the calendar. You know, I don't think it's like Martin Mays. We've never been to Belgium and is one of the most consistent names right up there in enduro. I think the actual results don't bear the theory out, right? What else have you got for us?
Well, I was going to add to that, actually. Obviously, we see quite a lot of riders walking stages now before practice and the race begins. And to me, that's more advantageous than if I could ride a stage once or walk it once before the race, I'd always walk it. I think you learn more, you can take more in. Obviously, it's a bit of a 6 and 2 3s with riders. You know, some people would rather kind of ride it on instinct and learn less and save their energy, and other riders would rather spend the day or two that it takes to maybe ramble about in the forest and learn. So I was certainly the variety that if I could walk it, I would.
You'd walk it over riding it. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think when you're riding it, like even a cruisy pace for an EWS rider is pretty damn fast. So you can only take so much in. But yeah, I always found that walk it, practice it, I'd know where I was going, I'd use the GoPro in my practice run, and then I'd just review it before the race again. And I found for me that was the best way to learn and or to try and learn stages, because, I mean, when you've got 25, 30 minutes of stages to learn, it's difficult to know that, like, the back of your hand in one run.
Well, we have seen, I actually asked, I think it was last season, yeah, 2020, I was at the bottom of a stage and Eddie Masters came down, finished the stage, and I noticed he had a GoPro on. And I asked him if we could get some of the footage for our highlights show, and he said that he actually had the GoPro with him to re-watch stages at the top of it. And his helmet was actually the most secure, easy place to put it. And I thought that was really, really interesting. From having a limited mental bandwidth like mine, my issue would be is if you're out there in the hypothetical world of if you had access to what you knew was going to be the stage, it was closed and there was no penalties involved for you riding that stage for 3 or 4 weeks back to back, head of the race. Come race week itself, you've got such limited practice, you can walk it once. Am I right? You can walk it once, you can ride it once.
You can walk it as many times as you want, but obviously with the way the schedule works, there's probably only going to be 2 days before practice starts where it's actually marked. Then you get one practice run.
You do that, all you're going to be noticing throughout this whole process is 3 or 4 weeks that you've been riding, that the changes that are occurring. Whereas if, like, you're fresh to it, you see the changes shorter term. I think that's just more useful, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's something that's not often talked about, how stages develop. I've always been of the kind of opinion that there's thousands of people who can ride a perfectly smooth trail very fast when there's no pressure on, and then as soon as the clock starts and you're riding a beat up trail with corners that are blown out and breaking bumps, and you're having to ride on instinct that there's only maybe 50, 60 riders in the world that can go that fast when the chips are down. But anyhow,
well, I don't know, this is something that, having talked to Nigel Page from Chain Reaction, it's one of the things he returns to. Why he thinks Sam Hill is as good as he is because he's just got the ability to process a track mentally and can just, as you say, ride it at that pace and adapt to whatever changes. If you're walking or riding the track, will there be corners that you see where you'll probably mark mentally and go, there may be an inside form in there, there may be an outside?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I would definitely practice stuff, and on my GoPro would comment, that'll be blown out. Like, I'd voice over the top of it, and then when I was watching it before the race, I'd know that coming into a corner, chances are on race day I would, like, check up, brake, and then cut inside, because I knew the outside was going to be gone, and if it wasn't going to be gone, then it was going to be pretty chopped out. So yeah, I think that comes with experience, you know, kind of understanding terrain, understanding how it's going to form, and you know, sometimes in practice, the way it works, like, you might be one of the first riders down a stage, and then when you have the other 300-400 riders practicing behind you, plus the amateurs racing it in front of you, you can be talking like 700-800 sets of wheels through it before you get there for the second time in the race. So you have to anticipate that, but you also have to ride, as I would call, kind of head up. You have to kind of be able to react to what's in front of you, not just pre-program it and think of how something's going to be exactly before you get there. Like, you have to kind of ride what's in front of you and react if necessary. And I think that's one of the biggest separators for enduro, to be honest, is because you don't learn the tracks like the back of your hand, you get a limited amount of time on them. It is a different style of riding. You have to ride as fast as you possibly can, but still have time to react to something that might be different. It's quite a, I always found downhill, it was like I always set off and knew exactly how something would feel. I'd almost be able to tell you the time I was going to do. Whereas enduro, it's kind of, there's a little bit more thinking on your feet and instinct and reactiveness. And I guess it's I think that's probably the biggest separator and why it's difficult for riders to jump across and be, you know, as fast straight away, because that's a skill you have to learn and develop. I think hours on this, to be honest.
I think it's it's a good thing you say that, because it's one of the requests we've had, is that we do put an episode together where we do a complete sort of guide to the kit and, you know, bike stuff that people who are going to be entering their first EWS event have sorted. And from what you're saying there, a good GoPro or the equivalent action camera that you can use during practice, just to give you an idea, like just a bit of a mental jog of where everything is, should be on that list. So we'll come back to that in the future, right? Give us another one.
What else have we got? Can you tell us more information about the double events for 2021 and the new pro stage?
Oh, well.
I know
just the man who can tell you more about that. Ruairi, please tell us more about that.
So the double events for this year, I'm really excited for them, to be honest. It kind of rolls on from what we've just spoken about. Obviously, we're still in a pretty interesting climate internationally, and when planning the season this year, we wanted to kind of cut down the amount of travel between races, cut down our kind of global footprint, and really the option of hosting double events, similar to what we'd say the World Cups last year, was a really good option. We're pretty selective with the venues we chose. So obviously we have Val de Fassa as the first one, La Tuile a couple of weeks later, and then Ludenville in France towards the end of the year. And a lot of these are, well, all three of these are big alpine venues. They've got chairlift access, all have a very, very established trail network and have the infrastructure in place that allow us to host a double event. The interesting thing, I guess, with the double event is the course is going to stay relatively similar between the Thursday race and the Sunday race. So the schedule is as current. Whereas the pro race will be the practice Wednesday, race Thursday. The pros will have a day off on Friday when the amateurs practice. The amateurs will race Saturday. We'll have the new pro stage Saturday evening, and then the pros will race Sunday. But I think it'll be really interesting to see if there's any riders go faster on the Sunday versus the Thursday, purely because they know the course better.
It's a different thing, isn't it? It's a different complexion because, like, you do see that with different pro riders. I remember after the titanic battle there was between Sam Hill and Richie Rude in North Star a couple of years ago, Sam told us afterwards, sort of quite candidly, that he'd race again tomorrow. Because he was that fired up, he knew where he was going. He wanted to take Richie back on again. So the prospect of that, do you know what I mean? A close race early in the week, setting the tone for a race again at the weekend on stages that they now know. It's absolutely fascinating. And then tell us quickly then about the pro stage. What is that?
Yeah, so the pro stage is it's new for this season, and I guess it's just a really kind of exciting and action packed way to kick off the EWS races. So it'll be a Saturday, kind of late afternoon, early evening stage, and it's going to be relatively short. I'd imagine kind of 3 to 6 minutes in length. The stage will be specifically designed so it'll be kind of high speed, good visually, and should provide some really, really close racing. And we've introduced extra points for the top five positions. So that'll make riders kind of really go for it to try and get those extra points, and it's also the final stage on the Sunday as well, so it'll be repeated as the final stage of the race. So look, I think it's going to be exciting. I think we're going to see some really, really close fast racing to start each of the races, and it'll be interesting to see how riders approach it. Like, obviously there's certain riders you put your money on going 110% trying to win it.
Stop you there. That's impossible. You can't go 110%.
Oh, well.
We're going to have a percent rule on this podcast because that is one of my red buttons, I'm afraid. Right, so you're going to go 100%. Carry on.
110%. I can.
I bet you can with that haircut.
Yeah, haircut's 110%. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Obviously, there's riders who we kind of no, aren't afraid to go beyond their limit, shall we say. Can you do that?
Yeah, that's well, I'm more comfortable with that than 110%. Right. But
okay,
I think the big thing about that is it's going to put one of the ideas behind this pro stage as well is to really put it in front of as many sets of eyes as we can as well, in front of spectators, and it's going to be somewhere that we can, you know, obviously in the COVID age, we can get as many people, hopefully, as we can at the side of it and really show the sport off and the sort of speed that top guns are going. Give us one more then before we wrap the podcast.
Oh, last question. What should we go for? Here's a good one. Who are the up-and-coming riders to look out for in 2024? This is a funny one. I think, obviously, we'd spoken already about Antoine Vidal.
Yeah.
I think he'll create waves in the VWS class. Be interesting to see. I know he's spoken about doing some more this year. It'll be interesting to see how Jamie Edmondson goes this year, I think. Obviously, his World Cup success was pretty amazing, and he had three podiums in a row in under 21 at the races in 2020. I think he'll have learned, if he does come back, and I think he's planning to, I think it'll be pretty interesting. I imagine he'll have learned a lot. Maybe he kind of understood the way to approach it, like we discussed earlier, and I could see him being up there. Who else?
Estelle Charles, first podium last year. She's 23. Mm. I think we're starting to see her sort of get the hang of that pro women's speed. I think she's going to be up and around it. I think the big name really is Vidal. I think Vidal is going to be, he's the kind of like, he's like a French Dolph Lundgren, isn't he, from Rocky? Like, he comes on form, that could be like, you know, I think he's got, in the build up to this, he's really like, he looks like the complete package if you talk about the modern enduro racer, do you know what I mean? And as you've said before, there may be a bit of learning there to do about keeping it rubber side down over the course of the season, but certainly in terms of raw pace, right in amongst it from the get-go, I think.
Yeah, certainly from the UK, I can't say I know too further afield. There's a young kid called Jaden Randall. I think he's under the wing of Tracy Mosley's Timo program. I've been pretty impressed with the riding I've seen him posting online. Polly Henderson as well, and a local girl from around here could go pretty well.
Polly Henderson's a good shout. I've ridden with her, she's pinned.
I remember last summer as well, there being a name of a young kid riding for Yeti in America. Was it Casper
Woolley?
Woolley as well. I'm pretty sure he showed some pretty...
I think he's back on their development team again for this season. So, I mean, Yeti, if you're going to talk about anybody developing young riders, particularly North American riders, that's where he should be, isn't it, really? I think, I mean, not up and coming in terms of age, still a young guy. I think we're going to see a lot more of Reese Ferner as well. Really sort of has just been building and building a wee name for himself over the last couple of seasons. One of the breakthrough riders on Team Canada's Bluegrass Trophy of Nations team from 2019. And just, he won the Queen Stage somewhere last season, didn't he, as well?
The Queen Stage in Pietra.
Yeah.
So, and is Harriet Harnden moving up to...
Harriet Harnden is moving up, I think that's a year early, to pro women. So, that's a massive one. Another Tracy Mosley protege, I guess you would call it. Tracy sort of, she's doing what sort of, what Steve Peake did about 10 years ago in downhill, isn't she? She's just bringing in all these young names that you're looking at and going, that's a really polished package. Hattie, very much in that modern vein of a young rider, in that she rides absolutely every discipline under the sun. She's multiple cross-country, multiple cyclocross national champ. Certainly, you saw her whenever she turned up to races last season, just really enjoying herself, completely unfazed by it and going very, very fast. So I definitely think she's someone that we'll see up there as well.
Yeah. Potential race winner?
Yeah. I'm going to go podium. I'd say a definite contender for a podium in 2021. And you never know, like, these enduro races are funny things, and if people get into a bit of form and get on a roll, do, you know, do the business on one stage and manage a lead. Absolutely, why not? Look, we're going to call it there, Rory. Thank you very much, as ever, for your time. I know you're an extremely busy man.
No worries.
Everyone, please, if you are thinking about sorting yourself out an entry for an EWS or an EWS e-race in 2021, get online, do a bit of homework, and then get ready to get your slot secured, and then you can be at an EWS, at an EWSE, taking on the same stages as some of the biggest names in mountain biking. Rory, thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
See you later.